Good morning. Today's date is February 17th, 2020, and you're listening to Episode 7 of Coronavirus Central, your daily source of information about the novel coronavirus of 2019, now being called COVID-19, or alternatively, SARS-CoV-19. I am your host, Tom Kaczynski, and today we're going to offer the tracking about the number of cases, a lot more detail about what's been happening with the international response, a couple rumors, a little bit of news, and try to give you a better feel for what's happening out there and why you are hearing and are not hearing certain things. This podcast represents the combined efforts of a public open source information network, which we invite you to join. All podcasts for this program will be hosted at coronaviruscentral.net. And questions can be sent to the podcast at coronaviruscentral@pm.me. Our Telegram group is t.me/coronaviruscentral, and videos will now be posted as simulcasts on YouTube after their creation. So we want to make sure that this broadcast is available on many sources. It's also available on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. And if there's somewhere we need to get to that would help you, please let us know. And assuming it can be done easily, I will try to accommodate. We are an independent organization working internationally in search of the truth and the safety of all against this terrible pandemic. Thank you for listening. So now that we've gone through the little blurb at the beginning, today's show is going to be a little bit different than some of the other ones we've done. We've been really heavy on the medical side for a while, and I wanted to focus more on what's happening and what isn't happening. And one of the biggest challenges in looking at COVID-19 is that we are dealing with an information blackout in many ways. It seems pretty self-evident to those of us who are studying this that there is a deliberate situation where the public officials are trying to release as little information as humanly possible. Some might say that is in purpose of clarity because of the many unknowns about the coronavirus, which we are trying to assess and frankly, which are frightful to those of us who are. Others would take a different view of saying that governments and public health institutions alike have decided to scare away the scrutiny that would come from public oversight by remaining quiet about this. And I think that that's equally true, that we see the elements of, deliberate silence from the media on many of these issues in the full depths out there. And I'm going to try to make that case for you based on some evidence here today so that you can see what does and doesn't add up. And as we go through that, we're going to talk about some of the institutional actors, some of the ways in which they're behaving quite oddly, anecdotal evidence that is starting to accumulate that this is far greater than the public is being prepared for. And we're going to close today, after we look at the CDC and the WHO, we're going to look a little more about some stories coming out of China about a potential patient zero. And these are highly speculative, but one of the things our open source intelligence network is allowing is we are now directly interfacing with Chinese dissidents and Chinese victims of this virus who are sharing information on the ground about what they're talking about on their sort of restricted social media. So we're going to take a little glimpse behind the Great Firewall of China and see what they're trying to solve, because they, understandably, are very curious about who is responsible for this. They want to know if this was something that was done by their government against them, whether it was an accident by their government, whether a foreign actor was responsible. And these questions really matter, because when you have a death toll now, well into the thousands and potentially quite higher if you believe what the people in China do, people do want someone to be held to account. And while in war, truth is often the first casualty, and this is now a war, a global war for humanity against this virus, I think that it's really important that we take a moment and kind of go deeper into some of these questions. And so that's what we're going to do today in the show, and we'll see how much I can actually get out of it for you. But we'll go through, and hopefully it'll be a good show and it'll be an interesting one. And tomorrow we'll go into some of the supply chain issues that I've been promising, because I'm trying to understand. It looks like, though, just as a really brief message, that you're going to start really feeling the hurt about 3 to 4 weeks from now in terms of global supply chain shutdowns. And you see promises that the Chinese workers are going to go back to the assembly lines, but I don't think that's realistic, as we now have 760 million people. And just to put that in context, that's nearly twice the population of America under quarantine lockdown. And we have a growing body of evidence that reinfection from COVID-19 actually is worse than the first time around. So we'll see what happens with that. But I understand market signals, and we'll go past that. So, all right, so as always, let's start with the numbers today, right? So today's date is, February 17th. We have an updated stream as of 6:50 a.m. on the East Coast, and the exact time I'm recording this, it's 7:15 a.m. So the current numbers being reported are that there are 71,415 cases around the world that have been confirmed. And the number of deaths is 1,775, and the number of recoveries is 11,312. And I have to say, I have an issue with that recovery number, because we have growing body of evidence that people can be reinfected. So while I'm glad that people are surviving a first case with this, I would be very cautious in how much we read into that. And we'll let the science catch up with the observations on that one. But to give the numbers of just confirmed cases by country here, and you can see some of these spikes are starting to happen. Mainland China, 70,553. Japan is at 434. Singapore, 75. Hong Kong, 58. Thailand, 35. South Korea, 30. Malaysia, 22. Taiwan, 20. And then Vietnam, Germany, 16, Australia and the U.S., 15. And those numbers are constantly rising all the time, and they should be. I did something this week to try to help a little bit with this, because one of the things we really need to talk about is why these numbers don't make sense. And I'm going to start with an article. This is from Barron's, and it was published originally on February 13th. And now it's been updated on February 15th by Lisa Belfus. And it says, this is in their economy and policy section, China's coronavirus figures don't add up. This never happens with real data. And what it says basically is, I'll just read the first couple paragraphs. China's economic data have always been fraught. Now all eyes are on the coronavirus numbers, which economists and investors are using to estimate the outbreak's toll, and they're too perfect to mean much. A statistical analysis of China's coronavirus casualty data shows a near-perfect prediction model that data analysts say isn't likely to naturally occur, casting doubt over the reliability of numbers being reported to the World Health Organization. That's aside from news on Thursday that health officials in the epicenter of the outbreak reported a surge of new infections after changing how they report the illness, how they diagnose the illness. The most current WHO data count, more than 60,000 cases of infection and nearly 14,000 deaths. Most of those cases and all but one death have been in China. Tostin Sloak, chief economist at Deutsche Bank Securities, expects the outbreak to shave 1.5 percentage points off the Chinese GDP this year. All right, let's skip through all this here. So, all right, we'll just skip here. In terms of the virus data, the number of cumulative deaths reported is described by a simple mathematical formula to a very high accuracy, according to a quantitative finance specialist who ran a regression of the data for Barron's. A near-perfect 99.99% of variance is explained by the equations. Put in an investing context, that variance, or so-called R-squared value, would mean that an investor could predict tomorrow's stock price with almost perfect accuracy. In this case, the high R-squared means there's essentially zero unexpected variability in reported cases day after day. So what they're basically saying here is that the data that's being reported from China follows such a predictable formula that it's fake. And the way it works, and I've seen the equation in question, it's basically a quadratic equation where they have decided that there is a certain level of cases they're willing to admit to, and that they're not going to share anything else. And then, you know, beyond that, estimates of what's actually happening on the ground vary incredibly widely. And from the example of Miles Guo, who was on the pandemic war room with Steve Bannon, who said that that number was potentially, 50,000 dead and 1.5 million infected. We had a source in China that reported to us that their internal speculation, supposedly from the party, this was 4 days ago, was 1.5 million infected and 250,000 dead. And what we know is that if the other information being reported that we've talked about from the existing scientific literature of a case fatality rate of at least 2% and an infectivity rate of anywhere upwards from 3 to 5 or higher is true, then we know China's numbers are probably cooked. And what we're seeing is we're seeing this internationally. And just for an example, I went ahead and put something together here that we could work with. And this is a very simple calculator, and I just want to give you an example of what ends up happening. You can kind of figure out how many people should roughly be sick based upon a little bit of information. If you know the number of people who are actually sick, or we can use the diagnosed number, even though that's likely an underestimate, and you understand what percentage are severely ill, assuming those people are the ones who are going to go and go to the hospital, whereas people who don't think they're sick don't go, and you understand also the number of which who report, which I've just estimated at half, because half maybe go because they're that sick and half go don't go because they're scared of that hospital. But we can adjust these. The transmission rate, that's the R-naught value, and how quickly it doubles. So I'm just using what, and I'll just tell you, I'm using this for the United States of America, okay, where theoretically we have 15 people diagnosed. We know from international stats that somewhere between 15 and 25% get severely ill and need ICU support. So we picked an average value of 20. We'll assume half the people report. I picked a transmission value of 6 just based on the numbers that we've been seeing out there. I think that that's a nice safe number that's not too high. And we also looked at this to double every 2.4 days, which is what the latest research reports as we shared on Friday. And so in theory, here's what that means, and this is why it should be a little scary about progression, is if 15 people are reporting, and we figure for every person who reports that there's someone who's sick and doesn't know it, that there's literally 4 of them, you end up with 75 who are probably infected. Another 60 people who are having minor expression of this disease, maybe they think it's the flu, maybe they think it's nothing, they're fighting through it. But if that was actually true, and this fits the numbers we've observed on the ground, and now we've observed on the cruise ship, the Diamond Princess, which where everyone seems to be getting sick, and they're now up into, I think, over 300 being sick now. We would see a progression that looks something like this. If on day one, there were 15 people reported, if this was actually how it was spreading, on day 5, you would expect 375. On day 10, you'd expect nearly 1,700. On day 15, you'd expect 3,940. And each of these represents just a small percentage of the number of people who are likely infected when you actually look at this. Because when you actually look at the numbers, you would expect that actual infection number to potentially be twice this amount, or excuse me, 5 times this amount because of the number of people who aren't out there. So if you see 15 people infected, that probably means 75 are. If you see 1,000 people, that could mean 5,000 or more because there is a delay in this long period. And all of this basically goes to say that everything that has been reported about the data suggests that there should be an exponential expansion in terms of the number of people who are suffering this disease. Now, I understand that there is a problem with test kits not being able to measure this, and I understand that there are limits in what the public health system can assess. Nonetheless, what they are doing is hiding behind numbers that otherwise suggest that we are not dealing with nearly as bad of a pandemic. And the governments of the world seem to have pretty much accepted the idea they're not going to tell you things. And that being the case, we'll go ahead and look at some of the problems that are out there. We'll start with this article from the New York Times, and this was from the 12th, and it reads, Corona test kits sent to states are flawed. Some tests distributed by the agency deliver inconclusive readings. The CDC will need to ship new ingredients for delaying tests. And we have heard that there are 30 to 50% of these test kits who are inaccurate. We've seen false positives. We've seen false negatives. And as such, we can't really believe any of the things coming from these test kits. And what I found was interesting, and I'm going to ask you to remember a name here. The woman who was quoted for this thing, she said, obviously, a state wouldn't want to be doing this test and use it to make clinical decisions if it isn't working as well, as perfectly, at the state as it is at the CDC, said Dr. Nancy Messonnier, director of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases, as she said at a news conference on Wednesday. And I pause there for a moment because we should talk about Dr. Messonnier. She has a really interesting background, as it turns out. She is the sister of Rod Rosenstein. And for those of you who don't recognize that name, he was previously the Deputy Attorney General of the United States of America, heavily caught up in a number of different items that were related to issues related to Russiagate, to impeachment, to all those things. So this gets very odd that you have these family relationships. And there has been circulating throughout the internet that there is... So as I was saying, there is this curious thing about Dr. Nancy Messonnier, who ended up being featured pretty prominently on a thread that originated on TikTok, where supposedly the son of a colleague of hers received this text message from her. And I have no way to assert if this is accurate or not, but it has been very widely spread. And I think it's interesting, so we will share it with you, keeping in mind that I can neither confirm nor deny the veracity of this, other than the fact that I think it's an interesting rumor and perhaps indicative. So, and the person who brought this up to her, she has basically gone silent on social media since this is broke, because people are asking questions. So the friend wrote, hi, Nancy, hope all is well. I was just wondering if you could fill me on what's happening with this coronavirus, hearing conflicting things about it. Is it as bad as it is said to be on the news, and should we have to worry? Thanks. Signed, Frank. And Dr. Messonnier wrote back, hello, Frank. Good to hear from you. I hope the kids and your wife are doing well. We are still investigating everything. However, I can tell you this. It's worse than what's being said on social media and nationwide news. We're trying to prevent panic, as that will only make things worse. Please keep that between us. There have already been over 1,000 cases in the United States. Although on the news, they're just keeping quiet for now and reporting far less to the public. Wear masks when if traveling, even nearby distances. We suspect cases in over 32 states at this point. If we don't ensure our safety measures as fast as we'd like, this could spread much faster than we expected. Please stay safe. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. All the best, Nancy. And that was what she provided as an answer to this man. So do I know that that's true? No, I don't. But if we go down the rabbit hole, there was a really interesting phone call that I had a chance to listen to. And this is from Dr. Paul Cottrell's show, who he's on YouTube, and he has about 22,000 subscribers. He had a caller call into him from New York State alleging that there was a major CDC cover-up happening there, that a gag order had been issued to first responders, that's fire and law enforcement, and that they were being told not to report 6 cases that were in the Buffalo area alone, which is very disturbing. And you can listen. I'll put up a post to it so you can listen to the case and judge the veracity of this. I've heard of a case doing the same in Texas. I've heard of one in Kentucky, one in Michigan, one in Florida, one in Maine. So whatever is happening, it seems like there is a deliberate effort to keep things silent. And if you ever want proof of it, go into an emergency room and just act like you might have come to China. My wife and I had to go to an emergency room recently for a totally unrelated issue. And they were there excuse me, we were speaking about, she was just there for a foot issue, had nothing to do, and we haven't traveled, obviously, but we came in with masks, and you should have seen how fast they swarmed us in our small emergency room. And so you have to look at the reactions rather than the statements being made by the CDC. And I think that there's quite a bit of evidence that the CDC is failing. And I'll give you another example of this. So we shared that article from New York Times about how the test kits are failed, and we also have another one now. Now, this is from the University of California, San Francisco, and this is dated February 13th, and it's called How the New Coronavirus Spreads and Progresses and Why One Test Might Not Be Enough. And in this, I'll just read real quickly here, that says that a novel coronavirus that first appeared in Wuhan in December continues to sicken tens of thousands of people around the world, and scientists are working round the clock to better understand the virus, contain the outbreak, and treat the disease. In the weeks since the outbreak, the disease has been named COVID-19 by the World Health Organization, although the virus itself has been named SARS-CoV-2 by the International Committee on the Taxonomy on Viruses. We're going to return to that in a minute. That's actually really important, but let's leave that alone here. UC San Francisco infectious disease expert Charles Chu, MD, PhD, has been following the disease since its outbreak and provided the latest updates on what science has revealed about how the coronavirus is transmitted, what happens to someone who's infected, and why a single diagnostic test may not be enough. And they just talk here about how they say it goes to droplets and surfaces, although we do believe that there is evidence that there may be aerosolization and that it's spread through through feces. But it reports here it's probably less deadly than SARS, but more deadly than the flu, that the disease progresses over 7 days. I'm just scanning here. Treatments are being experimented and unproven. Those who recover from COVID-19 may not be immune forever. I think that's important, especially since they're talking about, you know, recovery as if that somehow it grants safety. It only creates a different new problem for people. And a single negative test may not rule out infection, which is what I want to go to here. The currently available diagnostic test is a PCR test developed by the CDC, which looks for RNA from the virus. However, hospitalized patients infected with the new coronavirus can have test amounts that vary from day to day because the amount of virus produced by the body can change throughout the course of the illness. So in short, we don't know. The test may not be reliable. We're having this in the middle of flu season. And we have a CDC that at least we have some anecdotal evidence is lying to us. We have statistical evidence is lying to us. And if you want to really feel even less confident than you probably already do, I would recommend there was an event. It was broadcast by the Center for Health Security. You can look them up on YouTube, and it was called the Event 201 Pandemic Exercise. And in this event, they had officials from the CDC, not from just the United States, but from China, from the World Bank, from the World Health Organization, major international actors, and they, in October in New York, were speculating what would happen if there was the outbreak of a major coronavirus pandemic that had a very high fatality rate. Now, this one they had started in swines that came out of South America. But other than that, you will be startled and dismayed, perhaps, at the similarities to what we've had here. But what they do is they convene in this meeting, and there's an 11-minute video I'll share as the introduction. But it's a three-hour conference, and I've watched the whole thing. And I will say what you learn is that the economy will fall apart. The supply chains will break down. And mind you, this was for a case in South America, not one in China where the majority of medicine manufacturing happens. But you also learned that their communication strategy was that they wanted to control information because they made the assessment that as people became aware of what this disease would be, theirs that they had in there, what ended up happening was that the economy started to break down, as did the ability to offer resistance to the virus. And the quarantine measures that they tried in this failed as well, so they eventually decided not to focus their efforts there, but to focus towards treatment, vaccines, you know, maintaining structure and order, because they were more concerned, and you can see this as you watch this in a lot of ways, with civil instability and protecting the various governments involved in the engagement, as well as the international organizations, than they were about the rising casualty count, which they felt they would be unable to stop. And when you look at the mindset that they very clearly express there, you can see, in fact, from this exercise that much of the recommendations that were considered there are being implemented. And it's really worth watching. It will be dismaying, but I think that you deserve to know that, you know, what is happening with your government and just how poorly they're acting. And I'll give you another example. This is another story, but it really should be upsetting. And this is from NBC Channel 7 News in San Diego. That's NBCSanDiego.com. And it says, quarantined evacuees demand oversight and new petition against against CDC. And this happened because here, let's see here. Soon after we'll just read it. After the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released an isolated patient who tested positive for the coronavirus back into general quarantine at the Marine Corps Air Station Miramar, the other patients started a petition to demand better oversight. A lot of sentiment expressed that we need to make some suggestions and get some feedback, said quarantine patient Jake Wilson. Wilson shared the petition a day after the woman who tested positive for the coronavirus was mistakenly released by the UC San Diego Medical Center. Soon after the woman was discharged, the CDC notified her that her test results were mislabeled due to pseudonyms used for privacy reasons. Nice to see the bureaucracy is going to get people killed because they want to go ahead and protect our privacy. Who cares about our lives? We only care about bureaucratic accountability. And she, in fact, tested positive for the virus, according to local health official with knowledge of the case. But before the error was discovered, she was briefly taken back to MCAS Miramar. In a statement to NBC7, UC San Diego Medical Center said the patient was returned to isolation with minimal symptoms. All right, so we could go through all this, and what you find out is that the CDC is inept and that the hospitals are not much better. And I don't mean to pick on people who are doing this. I mean, we do know that the CDC is now having mandatory testing of flu samples for coronavirus, although we don't know the efficacy of this test. In fact, we know it fails a lot. In Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, we also know from what we have seen of the quarantine doctor getting sick, who was using the best protection, we would presume, in his interactions with the people on the Diamond Princess, that this is a very virulent, very infectious disease that's spreading, and that it's already into the hospital system all throughout the West Coast and presumably the East Coast as well. And if you're in a different country, I think if you've had people from not just China at this point, but from Singapore, Hong Kong, Thailand, Japan now being the second largest center, and a cluster starting to form in Tokyo, this is coming. And so what seems to be the case is that we see that they have, our government seems to have accepted this idea that even though they're hunting down certain people to slow down the expression of this case, they haven't done a quarantine because they don't think they can stop it. And that's the most logical conclusion for a lot of different reasons. What's equally a logical conclusion is that the numbers of people who are being infected by this are being deliberately unreported to prevent public panic. And I think we will find that the public health departments of all the states have been complicit in this. And it's something where, you know, only broadcasts like this, a couple other people, Dr. Martinson over at Peak Prosperity, Jim Medeker doing a good job on this. A couple people are trying to break through this blockade, but increasingly they are, you see social media being employed to attack the sources that are providing actual information of what's happening because they don't want people to be aware. And the argument is that this will hinder in some meaningful way the cure effort. But the truth is, if people are not prepared, if they're not getting supplies, if they're not quarantined, if they're not taking precautions, that the malfeasance by our governments and World Health Organization are making and facilitating the spread of this virus, which leads to more people getting sick, a drain on resources, and things being unwell. I think it's time for honesty and accountability. And if we look at what the U.S. government is doing, not what they're saying, and this is a great example of this. This is from the MilitaryTimes.com. This briefing from February 7th, 2020, is that an executive, or I should put it this way, U.S. Northern Command is executing plans to prepare for a potential pandemic of the novel coronavirus, now called COVID-19, according to the Navy and Marine Corps service-wide messages issued this week. And they are specifically referencing an executive order directing the U.S. Northern Command to implement the Department of Defense Global Campaign Plan for Pandemic Influenza and Infectious Diseases 35-51-13. This document serves as the Pentagon's blueprint for planning and preparing for widespread dispersion of influenza and previously unknown diseases. All right, so the military is going onto war footing for this. They've already identified 11 bases. I read somewhere that now that number's up to 15. I don't have confirmation of that. I am seeking it. But I would love to read this document, 35-51-13, and see just what our government has in store for us. Because obviously it's a lot better than, or it's a lot more involved than, you know, go wash your hands and listen to the CDC and have, you know, other things lie to you. I don't know what all is happening out there. Like I said, there's a information blackout, and we are counting on you who are out there to help share some of this information. It can be done anonymously, but we want to get the information to the public. So if you're someone who has access to some of these documents, please let us know. We definitely want to let the people know what's happening. Because we know from little bits and pieces, this is from metro.co.uk, and this is from February 16th, written by Joe Roberts, but I think this is really interesting. Millions of Brits to be told to quarantine themselves at home for 2 weeks. And the article reads, millions of Britons, this is the United Kingdom, with flu-like symptoms could be told by authorities to self-isolate at home for 2 weeks if the UK's number of coronaviruses hits 100, it has been reported. Senior NHS, that's National Health Service over there, that's their healthcare plan, managers have been told the service will stop testing for the strain known as COVID-19 once around 100 cases have been confirmed across Britain, the Sunday Telegraph reports. And keep in mind that they probably have a similar problem as we do, and you won't see the reports of this meet the standard, even though it's probably likely, given the statistics of this, we're all over 100 already. But they don't want to say that because they don't want to upset the economy before they have to. But I think it's interesting that if this is accurate and that Britain's going to use 100 as the note at which you see quarantines action. And in China, we saw the big Wuhan quarantine start once it got into the low three digits. We should be seeing similar behaviors come out of Singapore and Japan probably later this week or around the end of the week. And depending upon what numbers get reported elsewhere, we should see it start following the week after that. So today, this week might be kind of a silly week in terms of people just acting like nothing's happening. But I think what we're seeing is the accumulation of resources behind the scenes, the sort of planning before the storm, like a hurricane before it hits. And I think one thing that I want to return to that I had mentioned in passing, but I didn't have the chance to hit as hard as I would like to. And this is from sciencemag.org here. And I think it's a really important thing. It's called an update. This is from Martin Ensering. And the update is a bit chaotic. The christening of the new coronavirus and its disease name create confusion. So COVID-19, I'll spell it. COVID-19. COVID-19. That's how Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, who is basically an Ethiopian hack, head of the World Health Organization, introduced the agency's official name for the new disease that's paralyzing China and threatening the rest of the world. The christening yesterday at one of WHO's now daily outbreak press conferences in Geneva ended 6 weeks of uncertainty about what the disease would be called, but it also created some new confusion. COVID-19 is a name for the disease, not the virus that causes it, which until now had a temporary moniker, 2019 nCoV, signifying it was a novel coronavirus that emerged last year. But the pathogen also got a new designation, which arrived before Tedros had even finished his press conference, by way of a preprint posted on BioRxiv by the body charged with classifying and naming viruses. The Coronavirus Study Group of the International Committee on Taxonomy of Viruses, the paper noted, had decided the virus is a variant of the coronavirus that caused an outbreak of severe acute respiratory syndrome in 2002-2003, so it named the new pathogen Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome-Related Coronavirus, or SARS-CoV-2. But that's not a name the WHO is happy with, and the agency isn't planning on adopting it. From a risk communications perspective, And that's how you know public PR BS. That's what that means. Using the name SARS can have unintended consequences in creating unnecessary fears for some populations, especially in Asia, which was worse affected by the SARS outbreak in 2003. So they literally are saying here they do not want you to respond to this virus with any sort of a rational response. A WHO spokesperson wrote in an email to Science, "For that reason and in others, in public communications, WHO will refer to the virus responsible for COVID-19 or the COVID-19 virus, but neither of these designations is intended as replacement for the official name of the virus that the study group has picked." All right, so, and you can go through all the details of this, why it goes through, and it basically is a long talk about bureaucracy, how the people who actually look at the viruses, the medical researchers, say, yeah, this is SARS in a new form. But the people who are the politicians, they go, we can't tell the public that. We're going to go ahead and have a different name for them. We're going to call it this COVID-19. So really what we should be calling it is SARS-2. And that's basically what they're admitting that this is. And it fits that we have this sudden acute respiratory syndrome that ends up happening. And I think it's worth reading the whole article. There's a lot of detail in it. But what you find is that it's the same political crap. And even CNN is reporting this, that the coronavirus, and this was published 10:47 last night by James Griffiths on CNN.com. And it says the coronavirus crisis is raising questions over China's relationship with the World Health Organization. So, sitting alongside, this is from Hong Kong, sitting alongside Chinese President Xi Jinping and Beijing's Great Hall of People, World Health Organization Director Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus was effusive in his praise of the country's response to the coronavirus. And what you basically read as you go through this article is that overwhelmingly they have gone ahead and they've just gone and totally sold out to whatever China says, accepted at face value. And there are two reasons why they do that. Number one is China has incredible pull in the United Nations, where they influence a number of nations for who is in support of this, that they were involved with a lot of the financial support for the Ebola outbreak in East Africa and West Africa, which I think is valuable. But they're also now the single biggest donor to the World Health Organization, especially as the United States under the Trump administration has made efforts to reduce our funding because of a belief that it is being misused for bureaucratization. Now isn't the time to get into those conflicts. It's just an opportunity to point out that the World Health Organization has spent more effort talking about winning the information war by not having people have prejudicial views as opposed to fighting the disease, going to the extent, as we now know, of contradicting the virologists about what they want to name the disease because they're afraid the public would understand just how much of a threat this is. And considering that it is not just SARS, but you have the HIV protein in there, you have a much higher infectivity. And what are they doing? They're going out there telling story after story in the international media about how the flu is worse, even though every scientist worth their salt, who is not a public relations person, is telling you this is something fundamentally different, with a virulence level that is as much as 10 times higher, and with a fatality level that may be 20 times higher or more. Remember, 0.01% of people die from the flu in an average year, and many of those people who do have underlying conditions that significantly complicate their scenario. So today we're going through a lot of the depth of how the sort of cover-up is happening. And these are, bits and pieces. They're anecdotal. But when you weave them together to form a coherent narrative, what you find is that the World Health Organization is basically covering for the governments. And that in the United States, as in China, the CDC that is acting there is realistically underreporting deliberately what is happening to the people. I don't want to say the information they're given about public health is bad, but what I am saying is that they are seriously underreporting these threats because they have been told to go ahead and estimate that the public health concern is less important than keeping the economy flowing. And we've even seen in some of the briefings here in the United States where the CDC director came up, and they hinted that they may reassess in 2 to 4 weeks. What they're really saying to you is, yeah, we know this is bad. We know we can't stop it. We're working on what we can, and we're trying to buy time. I think people would understand and respect that far better if they didn't lie the whole time. Because one of the things that is going to happen as this outbreak accelerates is that we will see a drain on resources that are sorely needed, both because of supply chain reasons, medical reasons, and the need to reapport resources. And that requires a very high level of trust. You don't get a high level of trust when your media lies to you, shuts down people who are saying the truth, and when the government is telling them to do so. And I think we will learn as cases accelerate. I'd be stunned if we don't, based on just the pure numbers, what we've already seen in China, what's beginning to happen in earnest in Japan and Singapore, that it will become very clear very quickly that a lot of lies were being told here in these early stages, and that there was a missed opportunity to enact a more aggressive quarantine that I think people can and should second guess. Nonetheless, we are all in this together, for better or worse, in all of our various countries, and I can only hope that the time they're buying is being better invested than protecting the narrow interest of a few, but instead working for the welfare of all the people who are a threat in this. And so today's show will close with an interesting sort of scenario, which is I've been spending a lot of time talking to some of our friends in China who are very much trying to resolve who was responsible for this virus. And I was tipped off to this research that they had been doing about a number of people who were at the biological laboratories in Wuhan. Now, it has been commented upon and often observed by people ranging from Senator Tom Cotton down to you and me listening to this broadcast that there's a very high possibility that, you know, it's worth observing that the virology laboratories there could have had a role in the outbreak of this disease. And so what I will do is I will read an article from the express.co.uk on this about a potential patient zero. I will share a rebuke from the Chinese central media, which came out really quickly, which usually is a sign, you know, maybe you're on to something, and just share a little bit of private intelligence that I have, which, once again, I don't make any statements as to its veracity, but I think it's interesting, and, you know, I think that it represents a pathway people could research, and I know people are in China. So let's start with the article. This is from Brian McLennan. Was this coronavirus patient zero? Scientist describes gruesome bat attack at Chinese lab. Coronavirus patient zero may have been a worker from a high-security pathogen laboratory working with coronavirus-infected bats, Chinese researchers have claimed. And you see they've been going back and forth. It was the bats, and it was the pigs, and it was the pangolin, but here's what they're saying. A research paper released by biologist Botao Zhao and Li Xiao points to a bloody incident at the Wuhan Center for Disease Control Laboratory, WCDC, less than 1 mile from the disease epicenter at the Wuhan Fish Market, which, by the way, a lot of people aren't buying that now, entitled The Possible Origins of 2019 nCoV Coronavirus, the paper said. A researcher described that he was once attacked by bats and the blood of a bat shat on his skin. He knew the extreme danger of the infection, so he quarantined himself for 14 days. In another accident, he quarantined himself again because bats urinated on him. The scientists from the prestigious South China University of Technology in Guangzhou claimed the Wuhan WCDC hosted animals in laboratory for research purposes, including 605 bats captured in nearby provinces. As well as the Wuhan food market, the lab is also located near the Union Hospital, where a group of doctors were among the first to become infected. The paper states the Chinese horseshoe bats were natural reservoirs for the severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus, which caused the SARS outbreak in 2003. The many virologists conform to a different scenario based on a genetic analysis that the virus was transmitted by a bat to another mammal between 20 and 70 years ago. This intermediary animal, not yet identified, then passed it on to its first human host in the city of Wuhan in late November or early December 2019. The Wuhan Institute of Virology, we report the findings of our 5-year surveillance of SARS-CoV, keep in mind that they're calling this the virologist SARS-2 now, in a cave inhabited by multiple species of horseshoe bats in Yunnan province in China. A paper released by Xinglao Yang of the Wuhan Institute of Virology described length genome sequences were obtained by the 5 patients at the early stage of the outbreak. They're almost identical to each other
and share 79.5 sequence identified SARS-CoV. Furthermore, it was found that 2019 nCoV is 96% identical at the whole genome level to a bat coronavirus. So this goes through here and... Okay, well, let's continue. According to the Beijing News, a research fellow at the Wuhan Institute of Virology called Shi Zhengli said on Saturday evening, "I can promise that not a single person was infected at our institute, including graduate students. We have zero infection cases." Another scientist from the institute, Chen Quanzhou, said the Wuhan Institute of Virology has no infections and patient zero did not come from us. Both Shi and Chen said they weren't aware whether there is a researcher called Huang Yanling at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And so let's start there for 1 second. So Huang Yanling is being depersoned, and she was at the Wuhan Virology School. She was graduate in 2012, and they have been, the Chinese government and the officials of that school have been erasing this woman from the internet, which is why a lot of people in China have wondered if she's patient zero. And there is a rumor and a story that goes around that sounds something like this, that she was handling this, containment was broken, she ended up dying shortly thereafter, but that the her remains were not properly disposed, and that patient zero, she's patient negative one because she dies, patient zero who spread this is someone who handled her remains. And that's the story that's out there. And the Chinese government has claimed she's alive and well somewhere in their western provinces, which would be like saying we went to somewhere in rural Alaska. But they won't. No one can find her. No one can identify anything. And that this woman has been erased from the record has led a number of Chinese people to speculate what's out there. But in any case, so the but she said this is obviously fake news. And that's the party line. We'll talk about that in a second. A high-security Level 4 biosafety lab, BSL-4, was built in Wuhan in 2017, and Chinese microbiologists celebrated their entrance to the elite cadre empowered to wrestle with the world's greatest biological threats. Before the opening of the lab, George Gao, director of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, key laboratory of pathogenic microbiology and immunology in Beijing, said it will offer more opportunities for Chinese researchers and our contribution on the BSL-4 level pathogens, which will benefit the world. Such labs are often controversial, and there has been an expansion of BSL-4 lab networks in the United States and Europe over the past 15 years, with more than a dozen now in operation or under construction in each region. The lab cost $44 million. And to allay safety concerns, it was built far above the floodplain and with the capacity to withstand a magnitude 7 earthquake, although the area has no history of strong earthquakes. It has a focus on the control of emerging disease, storing purified viruses, and acts as a World Health Organization reference laboratory linked to similar labs around the world. These laboratories are essential and at the forefront of research in developing cures to the world's most lethal viruses, potentially losing them as well, right? The Chinese Academy of Sciences approved the construction of a BSL-4 lab in 2003, and the epidemic of SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome around the same time, lent the project momentum. The lab was designed and constructed with French assistance as part of a 2004 cooperative agreement on the prevention and control of emerging infectious diseases. But the complexity of the project, China's lack of experience, difficulty in maintaining funding, and long governmental approval features meant the construction wasn't finished until the end of 2014. The lab's first project was a study, the BSL-3 pathogen that causes Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, a deadly tick-borne virus that affects livestock across the world, including in northwest China, and can jump to people. So this is what's going on in China, right? So this is the lab, and they're telling you, you know, bats went nuts and pissed on people and got blood on them, and maybe that's how it spread, or that it was a bit of bad fish. I don't know. This disease has so many problems that I can see why the Chinese people think that it could be a bioweapon rather than bat pee that's responsible. And they certainly believe that. And I will say this, that ChinaDaily.com, which is basically a spokesperson for the Chinese party, but They put out this article on the 16th, that's yesterday, saying Wuhan graduate never infected with novel coronavirus, according to the Virology Institute. And this talks specifically about Huan Yanling, graduate of the Wuhan Institute of Virology, a subsidiary of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, was not the first person infected with novel coronavirus, nor has she been infected with the virus, the Institute said on Sunday. They were real quick to get that out there. The Institute made the statement in response to information circulated widely online that Huang, a postgraduate student at the Institute, was the first patient to contract the novel coronavirus pneumonia in Wuhan, central China's Hubei province, the outbreak epicenter. And just to put this in perspective, this Institute is like 800 meters away from where the outbreak supposedly happened. So this is real close to there. The statement said Huang graduated with a master's degree from the Institute in 2015. Since graduation, she's been working and living in other provinces and has never been infected with novel coronavirus and is in good health. At this critical point in the fight against the epidemic, the rumor has greatly interfered with our scientific research work. We reserve the right to take legal action according to law, the statement said. So, China's telling you if you talk about this Huang Yanling woman, you're going to jail. Right. That's what we're dealing with, but that's what we deal with in this quarantine situation where governments are protecting themselves at the interests of the people. So, that offers you a little bit of a glimpse into the bureaucratic morass that is actually dealing with this terrible virus, do we call it COVID-19? Do we call it novel coronavirus? Do we call it SARS-2? That's what the virologists are calling it, and perhaps we should as well. I mean, I think if we want to be accurate, we should look at the science of this and not the politics. And look, I happen to know a little something about the dangers of identity politics, and another part of my life, I live in that world, and I understand how difficult and challenging that can be, and the desire to, that we need to get beyond this and understand that this is a human epidemic that impacts all people, regardless of your race, your nationality, or your point of origin. I think we need to evolve to that point very quickly and put aside all this political crap and try to solve the problem in front of us. It doesn't mean those other problems go away. I mean, the reality of this is that there's going to be major political, economic, and societal implications we cannot escape. We'll talk about them on this show as they evolve. At this point, the goal should be public health, how we can prevent these things from spreading, and what we can do as individuals, countries, and communities to keep people safe. And with regard to that, every time we do this show, definitely like to share some prepping tips that are useful. And the most important one, as I said in my book, Surviving Coronavirus at Any Price, or excuse me, on any budget, what you need to be able to do is get good information. And obviously, there is certain information from the government you can trust. There is certain information from the government you must not trust. And telling people how to finally hone their sense of awareness, really the most important thing is to look for logical inconsistencies. If someone tells you this isn't as bad as a flu, and then they go ahead and organize 11 or more military bases to handle quarantines, well, would the government do that for the flu? If the virologists are saying that this is a variant of the SARS virus that was incredibly deadly, they had an ultimate fatality rate around 10%, a little short of that, and then they say, no, this isn't as bad as the flu, are you going to believe what the researchers say, or are you going to believe what the political hacks say? And so one of the things that we continue to emphasize on this show is that you need to go ahead and act proactively, recognizing that the very silence that has been going out over the media over this issue is in fact very telling. Because if they could be reporting success stories about how they're defeating the coronavirus, when have any of you not known politicians to want to take credit for something? The fact that they are being completely silent and that the media is agreeing with it speaks to the severity of what we're facing. And as you go out there and you seek more information, just emphasize that there's a lot of rumors and there's a lot of noise to signal ratio. We shared a couple stories today about things we heard out there that are supposedly happening on the ground. There is, and then that's why we've built our open source intelligence network, because we really wanted to have access to that. But as we go through this, I think it's a good time to remind you of basic hygiene goods, the things you're going to want to get. Like I said, if you have nothing else, get some hydrogen peroxide, get some rubbing alcohol, 70%. You can use it as disinfectant.
Stock up on toilet paper. The supply chain is going to break down in 3 to 4 weeks, if not sooner, depending upon how quickly these things move. And if there's an epidemic in another place, like a Japan or a Singapore, you're not going to see the ability to silence this. The people who've looked at the numbers pretty hardcore think that given the sort of containment and expression measures, this thing may take as long as 10 weeks to fully manifest itself. And that's a hard spot to be in because we're all sitting here waiting, wondering what's happening. And in the meantime, I'm going to just try to give you the best information that I can about what items you can get and what news is out there. So hopefully some more news will break this week. What we are coming to understand is that this is a very serious outbreak. It's going to have global implications, and that it's going to be a real stress test for our society. So as always, you know, our hope and our prayer is for people to be safe, people to be well. We celebrate those who are doing good work and ask the politicians to get the hell out of the way. This isn't a time for them. This is a time for people who are serious about addressing this pandemic. So I'll close, as I always do, with a prayer for peace and comfort to the afflicted, the mercy for the suffering, and for those who have passed, for their families to find something to overcome their grief. And let's hope and pray that, you know, that some wisdom and insight comes to our public servants so that they can act instead of trying to save themselves to help save some of us. That's what our goal is here at Coronavirus Central. And we will be back tomorrow with a new episode. I'm expecting, absent breaking news, which can always happen, to look a little more deeply into the supply chain. That'll be my research for this afternoon. As a reminder, we are up on YouTube now. There will be a link in the description if you want to follow us there. You have to forgive me if we don't have the best visuals. Literally, I'm a one-man show in terms of just producing this. Although we do have actually some entrance music I was supposed to attach to this, and I'll have to work on that later today, because I really thank our members who are doing such a great job. We hope you'll join us. We're part of an international network now doing important work. So you guys be safe out there. We'll see you tomorrow.